Good evening and welcome to the third presentation in this, our 10th series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I moderate this series with my colleague in the white, Peggy Wright, and with assistance from our webmaster here podcasting and taking pictures, Haiwan Wan. Shadon Pruitt and Daniel Peach designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Daniel Pollard. Our speaker tonight is a native of Louisville, whose family's Kentucky roots date to the 1780s in Nelson and Marion counties. And growing up, he developed a passion for history and wanted to be a writer. He was called to a military career instead and influenced by generations of family members before him. And after an overseas assignment and 3 years of service, he returned stateside and studied geology at the University of Louisville before securing civilian employment with the Naval Ordnance in Louisville. In his spare time, he became interested in the Civil War after discovering his Marion County German ancestors had served in the 9th Kentucky Confederate Infantry. While searching for regimental burials at Cave Hill Cemetery in Louisville, he came across the weathered monument of the 1st German 32nd Indiana Infantry. Now, that discovery that changed the course of his life's work and which has evolved into a study of German military organization on both sides of the war. Soon after beginning his research into the Indiana Regiment, he discovered the activities of Captain Adolf Metzner, a German-born Louisville druggist, who soon after the war broke out had traveled to Indianapolis to assist in organizing a German regiment. Metzner recorded his day-to-day impressions of the war in a series of remarkable sketches as his regiment moved through Kentucky to Georgia and participated in the epic battles at Shiloh, Stones River, Chickamauga, and the March to Atlanta over the next 3 years. And after the war, the sketchbook was put in storage, and its rediscovery is the subject of this new book from the Indiana Historical Society by tonight's guest speaker, Michael Peek. Please welcome Michael.
It's always been an honor and a privilege to be able to share this artwork that survives today as a visual diary of not only what Metzner went through, but what the 1st German, 32nd Indiana encountered during 3 years of war in the Western Theater. Now, Adolf Metzner actually attended school in Germany in the village of La Roche, and then attended the University of Freiburg. He immigrated to America in 1856. Now, at the time of his immigration, he was 26 years old. So, coming from the state of Baden, he had to have met his military requirement to the Duke. They had a very strict mandatory military requirement beginning at age 18 for a minimum of 2 years, and everyone was subject to this. There were no exemptions, and individuals who actually escaped decided that they were going to immigrate and leave their families behind. Their families paid the price for their running away from that duty by the loss of their estates and everything that they owned. Now, here on the left you see Metzner probably at in 1862 or so, and this photograph comes from the Adolf Metzner collection of photographs in the Library of Congress. I always like to bring everybody's attention to this because I have it posted online at my website, and there are 13 photographs that need to be identified, so I need help in that regard. The one on the right is one of the very few family photographs that are included in this presentation. But Adolf Metzner immigrated in 1856, like I say, and then he landed up in Louisville, Kentucky, and opened up a pharmacy on Main Street with Henry J. Stein. It was Metzner and Stein, and it was at the Louisville Turner Club on Green Street in Louisville that William George Mank, over on the left hand, you see him in the uniform of 11th Indiana Zouave. Now, he belonged to the 11th Indiana 3 months regiment, and at the end of his service on the Upper Potomac, he came back to Indianapolis and joined forces with another gentleman to organize a Turner Sharpshooting Company for the 32nd Indiana. Now, this is another photograph on the right-hand side, but the reason I always like to put a photograph and a drawing together, you can see how accurate he was in his caricatures. And some of these are caricature in form, but these particular ones aren't so much so. But as I said, Mank joined forces with Captain Frank Erlemeyer, and they eventually organized a company that became Company A of the 32nd Indiana. Now, Frank Erlemeyer, he was one of those individuals who was given the option at age 17 to come to America. Of course, they lived in a different state of Germany, so they didn't have quite the stringent requirements as Baden did. But his father asked him, would you want to go into the military for 2 years, or would you want to go to America to seek your fortune? And he ended up in Indianapolis as an apprentice for a furniture maker. And it was ironic that here he was, he evaded military service to Germany, but he come to America, his new home, and immediately entered into military service. First with the 11th Indiana Zouaves, he was one of those who, he and Mank were comrades in the same company. But over here on the right-hand side, you see his rendition of him at Camp Nevin, Kentucky. And that was just a little bit below Glendale. I'm sure that you're all aware of Glendale up the road here. But just this side of Glendale, where the Nolin River, where the I-65 goes over the Nolin River, is pretty close to the Camp Nevin that they speak of. And they all fell under the command of General August Willich. Now, August Willich was one of the major leaders of the German revolutions of 1848. And as a matter of fact, you can't really seriously research any German regiment that served during the Civil War without making yourself familiar with the German revolutions of 1848. They're almost intertwined. Many of the men who immigrated to America to escape persecution in Germany became Union and Confederate commanders, more so in the Union Army than in the Confederates. But August Willich, he was one of the leading, in Baden especially, one of the major leaders. And when the balloon went up to organize the 32nd Indiana, you had men coming from all over the country, essentially, to join August Willich just on his name alone. But ironically, he received the Von Trebra brothers, who came from Arcola, Illinois, on hearing about the organization of the 32nd Indiana. Here you see Henry and Lewis. Lewis was quite smaller than his brother Henry, but even Henry himself was quite the runt, so to speak. But they're arriving at Camp Willich, which is actually pretty close to the RCA Dome is, if you're familiar with Indianapolis. That's pretty close to where the camp was. Here you see Major Carl Friedrich Heinrich von Trebra. Now this is von Trebra in the uniform of a Prussian Major of Infantry. And it just so happens that the awards that he wears there on his left breast are awards that the king had awarded to his loyal officers who fought against the revolutionaries during the war. So here these two men had fought on opposite sides in the 1848 revolutions, and they joined together to create one of the fightingest regiments of the Civil War. Their second in command was Major William Schnackenberg. Now he was a individual who brought his family to the United States in 1854. He had gained permission from the king to bring his entire family. He had been a former Prussian officer of artillery as well, and as well as August Willich had been. And the Prussian artillery at this time was the elite of all military. That was the special forces of the day, actually, was the artillery arm. It was considered the elite. But he came to America and settled in Evansville, Indiana, and was instrumental in creating a militia unit there in Evansville, even before the Civil War, because they had vast lumber interests over in the Green River Valley of Kentucky. They actually had the militia formed prior to the Civil War to protect those interests in Kentucky. And he organized an infantry and an artillery. And here you see the field and staff of the 32nd Indiana in 1861. Now you can tell that this is 1861 for the simple fact that these kepis that they're wearing on their heads, they didn't last no time in the Western theater. Now there were a few hard cases that managed to wear those kepis all through the war, but in this theater they quickly went to the slouch hat, and that was pretty much a change of the uniform. Very few of the men wore them after 1862, but you'll see a couple of holdouts. And here's Hans the cook. And I haven't been able to identify who Hans is, but they had a large, each company had its own cook, but then the regiment officers had their own cooks. So this is Hans the cook. And he was apparently a very disagreeable person because he seems to be intimidating Von Traber that's there on the left. And then here's Jacob Levinsky. Now this individual shows up in the artwork more than any other individual there is. I always hate to make a modern analogy with the Civil War regiment, but he, for lack of a better example, he would be the clinger of the 32nd Indiana without the cross-dressing. He shows up in more of the images, sometimes as the focal point or in the background, hidden. But you can always tell that he's there. After the 32nd Indiana organized, they left Indianapolis under strength and went to Louisville by way of Madison, Indiana as a show of strength. And then they were assigned to the New Haven, Kentucky, on the arm of the L&N Railroad. There, they were waiting for a Kentucky regiment to form there in the New Haven area. So they had gone to New Haven while that regiment stood up. But along the way, August Willick was able to reunite with Colonel Frederick Hecker. Now Hecker was at a post just north of Elizabethtown, Indiana, and he was the 24th Illinois, and that was the first Hecker regiment. It was the German regiment that was formed. He actually formed two German regiments during the Civil War. Shortly after this, he left that regiment, went up and reorganized another regiment that was trying to stand up and called it the 82nd Illinois, the 2nd Hecker Regiment. After leaving New Haven, they joined together. All the forces were under the 2nd Division at Camp Nevin, and this essentially became a basic training site for the 2nd Division. And men came from three different states, Ohio, Illinois, and Indiana, and this is where they turned the men into the soldiers. But the 32nd Indiana was thought to be the best regiment at this time because a lot of men had military training. A lot of them had served in European armies, and there were even a few that had, including officers, that had served in Algiers with the French Legionnaires. And I'll introduce you to those gentlemen in a little while. This is right after General Sherman had been relieved of command. This post had fell under the command of General Alexander McDowell McCook. Then General Buell came from the defenses of Washington to replace Sherman, and he instilled this real stringent code of discipline. You know, there would be no food outside of military food. And you can see that these three gentlemen here are being drummed through camp. Each one of them is wearing a barrel. They have chicken feathers in their heads. The barrel says chicken thief. They were drummed through camps. But, you know, today we try to provide our soldiers at least 4,000 calories a day and as many as, you know, half a gallon of water every 3 hours, depending on your environment. And during the Civil War, the calorie content was probably a third of that at best. And then potable water was always a problem. That caused most casualties in the Civil War from waterborne diseases. They reorganized here, and when Buell had taken over command, he was immediately pressured to make an offensive move against the Confederates who were down at Mumfordville, Kentucky. And now Mumfordville, Kentucky was a vital spot because of the enormous rail bridge that went over the river at that point. Now, before they moved on, though, they were trying to glean out all the bad officers they had. And there were several reports of some men in the 32nd Indiana that had fell under Willick's attention. Now, I want to draw your attention to the to his expression over here on the left-hand side. He's got his hand to his head as if he's saying, "My God, what's going to happen next?" But that was Metzner's study of this individual. And if you'll notice, he keeps on doing it. It must have been a characteristic of Willick that he carried through the entire army. But from here, you see there Jacob. That's his Jacob. He's getting ready to make the march. On December the 9th, they received orders to make the move on Green River, which is Mumfordville. They marched 13 miles that first day and ended up at a creekside. And 40 men of the 32nd Indiana volunteered to go forward to see if they could capture any of the Confederates at Mumfordville. But they made their move and arrived in Mumfordville to find it abandoned by the Confederates. But here's another scene of the troops, and they're still wearing the kepis at this time. But as I said, and then the tents that you see in the background, that's another give, tells you You can actually date it from the tents in the background. But along the way, naturally, they were harassed by Terry's Texas Rangers. This is the 8th Texas Cavalry. And these were men that grew up to the saddle in the counties around Houston and Dallas. And by no means were they green. But the 32nd Indiana arrived at Munfordville on the 10th. On the 14th, they had two of their men captured by the Rangers. And then on the 17th, while two companies were south of the Green River, the Texas Rangers under Hinman with artillery and infantry attacked the two companies that were on the south side of the river. The fight that ensued, it was one of the very few times in the Civil War when infantry was caught out in the open by overwhelming cavalry, and they managed to extricate themselves and fend off the attacking Confederates. Over on the left-hand side, which would be around Dixie Highway, right before it goes over the railroad tracks, Company C of the 32nd Indiana was on that flank. And then there was another Company B, Jacob Glass of Madison, Indiana, was over on the extreme right. And they probably had about 700 yards separating the two companies. But the 32nd Indiana, Sachs took 8 of his men out away from the rest of the company, anchored himself between two haystacks, and then challenged the Confederates to a duel, essentially. They quickly surrounded him, and they demanded his surrender. And allegedly, he fired both of his pistols. You see one here laying on the ground next to him, and he apparently jabbed one of the Rangers with the sword and brought him out of the saddle. And then he was literally riddled with gunshots. And out of the 8 men, 7 of them lay. It was just at that opportune time that another company came up on the flank. And at the time, there was also a flanking movement by Erdelmeyer of Company A, who got over on the flank of the artillery that had already started firing on the Union troops along the highway. And here's a personal combat between Von Traber and one of the Rangers. Now, there is an actual newspaper article where they speak of Von Traber's cold-bloodedness in killing this individual. He got down off of his horse and goes over and he retrieves his pistols and takes him back to the camp after the battle. But this was just a personal combat that he engaged in. And after the battle was over, there were 13 men of the 32nd Indiana were dead and another 24 were wounded. And here's three prisoners that are being brought up to Colonel Villick, and notice again, he's got his hand to his head wondering what's happening, it appears. I mean, this is just a Wilkism, if you would. But there is no mention at all in the official reports of prisoners being taken. However, Messner creates two drawings that shows three prisoners, and the newspapers, four different newspapers of the era, including one, or Nashville paper, speaks to three prisoners being taken, and I found record. Only two of them returned to the Texas Rangers. One of them died in March of the following year. And here's another scene where they brought the prisoners up to command headquarters. Mr. Fatty McCook right there, and that's a nickname that actually the newspapers tagged him in November of 1861. They called him Fatty McCook, and it apparently stuck with Messner, because every instance where you see McCook, you'll see that he's overblown, you might say. But this is one of the heartbreakers that didn't make it into the photograph's view. This is a massive piece of packing paper, and it would just cover this tablecloth. Images that you see there are probably in excess of a foot high, and it's just a fantastic drawing, and the detail is amazing, but the photographer didn't have the heart to try to unfold this massive piece of paper. But on the opposite side, the two drawings that I showed you of there was Sachs being surrounded by the Texas Ranger. That's actually two different drawings that are a panel apart. One of them's like right here and the other one's right there. And I put them together myself because to me it speaks to the actual event that occurred. And this is one of the, I haven't determined who this individual is, but this is his tongue-in-cheek view of one of the wounded men who had his head wrapped so tightly that it was drawing his eyes up. He says, Japanese ambassador. As I said, there were 24 wounded, and I think only one of them died from his wounds after the fact, and it was like 2 months later that he died. Now, this is the only scene that we know of that shows the 32nd Indiana Monument in situ at Munfordville, Kentucky. Now, what happened was, soon after the battle, one of the survivors of the battle, and actually somebody who had been highly commended for his action of removing a wounded soldier bodily from in front of Terry's Texas Rangers and running with him back several hundred yards, created this monument. He was a member of Company I of 32nd Indiana. His name was August Bodner. He created this monument in December and January, and we have a newspaper account dated January the 26th that shows this monument and a ceremony occurred when they put that graveside. You can see right now that there are actually 13 graves here. Now, I can date that to a specific time because only 11 men were buried here from the Rallock casualties. There were a total of 13 men killed. Theodore Schmidt and Lieutenant Max Sachs, their bodies were sent back to Cincinnati and buried there. Two more men died of disease, and the last one died February the 8th. So this was created after February the 8th because it shows the 13 bodies there. This is Mumfordville, Kentucky, and as a matter of fact, the cemetery is still there to this day. In December of 1862, they built a 5-gun fort around it with two magazines, and those magazines are intact to this day, and that's very rare in Civil War earthen forts. And there are actually graves in this cemetery still because there was an Ohio battery that was stationed there from December, you know, to the end of the war. And he married a local girl and had two kids. Well, that would have made her an dependent. But in the eyes of the Army, when they went to recover the bodies, they learned that this soldier had already been married to a New Albany lady. So they left the bodies of the woman and the two children there. So they're still buried there to this day. You can actually go up to this fort and determine what armament went where. They had some, it was a howitzer, and it required a traverse, and you can actually tell where that traverse was for that gun to be moved around. But it's an amazing place, and Fort Terrell is another one that's nearby.
That's the Baird Stokes?
Stokes Baird. Stokes Baird. Yeah, very good. I couldn't remember his name to save my life. The monument in 1956, and in 1994 when I started my work on preserving the monument. And it's heartbreaking, actually, but it's a beautiful monument, and we ended up, we were successful in our effort to preserve it. It took us 8 years to get the Veterans Administration to move it from the cemetery. They refurbished it and conserved it at U of L, and now it's on display at the Fraser International Arms Museum, or the Fraser, I don't think they're calling it that now, but it's on Main Street, and they put an exact duplicate from a cast in the graveside. German Frachter on one side, the English translation on the other. This is a meeting at Woodland House in Horse Cave, Kentucky. There were several meetings between the Confederates and the Union to talk about the prisoners that were taken on both sides. This is at the Woodland House, and I understand the Woodland House still stands to this day. This is Brigadier General Richard Johnson, and he was the brigade commander of the 32nd Indiana and the 15th Ohio, 34th Illinois for a short time, and then the 39th Indiana. But it changed just minorly. 34th went somewhere else, and they picked up another Ohio, the 49th Ohio. The reason I wanted to show you that is that's this gentleman right here that you see. I extracted it just to show you how accurate Messner always was with his art. And I would show you that this gentleman with his back to you, that's Adolf Messner. He places himself in several samples of the art. And there's a couple of views of Texas Rangers, Major Harrison and his Texas Rangers, one of the NCOs, and you notice that he's carrying a cavalry sword on his left hip. Apparently that is his service sword from the Prussian Army because the NCOs were not given swords until mid-1862. Now, this is the death of Xavier Bloder. This is one of the two men who died after the battle. This guy walks out of his hot chin and walks into the cold night air and drops dead from a heart attack. 34 years old. And the average age of the companies of the 32nd Indiana were a lot higher. For example, F Company, 32nd, their average age was 35 years old. Some long in the tooth soldiers in that. They had been professional soldiers in Europe. As a matter of fact, one of the officers of Company G, he was a French legionnaire in Algiers, and the reason he was the one who ordered his company to form square at Mumfordville, and that's why they were able to throw off the attacking rebels three different times, and it was because of their disciplined fire. And that was something that they had to develop against the Berbers in North Africa. But they always attacked in mass, and without the discipline and without the concentrated fire, you know, they would have been wiped out to a man all the time. But that's exactly how they fought the Terry's Texas Rangers there at Mumfordville. Velschvili formed his men into a square, and they fought off the Confederates. And they were outnumbered at least 2-1 at that time. And this is snoring. It's, what it says is, orderly, who is this that's snoring so loud? That's August Billick yelling at the tenant, his orderly. And he said, that's your lieutenant colonel. So Vaughn Traven's over there blowing the tent covers wide open. You know, they kept a sense of humor about him, even after they encountered some of the horrors of places like Shiloh. He managed to keep a sense of humor all through the war. And this is something that we can relate to. One minute it's raining in the Ohio Valley, and the next minute it's snowing. They had planned on moving towards Bowling Green. They were going to take Bowling Green. And up to this point, 32nd Indiana had been the lead element. But at this point, they received orders on the February the 10th to prepare to move, and they were going to make a forced march up to West Point, Kentucky. Donelson and Grant required troops from Buell's Ohio Army to come up and augment him. So they were on their way up. They got up to Upton and were turned around to march back the way they came after spending the night. They passed Rowlett Station 3 days later on their way to Bowling Green. This is just a few examples of his work, you know, on one sheet where he draws individuals of the regiment. These were men of Company A and the staff. You've got three of the doctors, Dr. Fisher, Dr. Krauth, and Dr. He calls him Dr. Johnson. He was the exception to the rule. He was the only Frenchman in the 32nd Indiana. Of course, there's Dr. Fisher. Now, Dr. Fisher was hired as a chaplain. However, he was a free thinker. So there wasn't much room for religion in the free thinking philosophy. But he was an able surgeon from Louisville, and he proved valuable because at this time, Krauth, he had contracted typhoid from the conditions there at Camp Nevin and working with the ill. He had contracted typhoid, which ultimately killed him, and Dr. Fisher took his place and arrived just in time. This is sick call, and you can see up here in sick call, there's Lewinsky waiting his turn while these guys right here are playing some kind of board game. And here's Fort Beauregard. Now, this is called Fort Beauregard. It was Baker's Hill, Fort Baker here in that you're all familiar with. The only armament that was ever there, Confederate armament, was 500 men from the 14th Mississippi. They were there stationed in bivouac there at the camp. This building here on the left, I understand, is Alexander McDowell's McCook when they arrived here on February the 23rd, 1862. They had to wait 3 days. The Barren River was out of its bank. They had to wait 3 days to cross, and then they crossed by steamer. He actually dates this in March of 1862, so I have to wonder if he did not come back through here before Shiloh on his way to Louisville or something, because it shows the bridge is intact now. Of course, that's a rebuilt bridge in the center for the highway. And over on the right-hand side, you see the L&M Bridge. Both of those have been destroyed by the Confederates as they retreated. So I'm thinking that he made his way back home to Louisville. He was still living in Louisville in March before Shiloh. But here they are on March the 3rd, they crossed the Cumberland River. Of course, he has it, the Tennessee River, but he would have never seen these boats on the Tennessee River. This is the Carondelet, the Essex, and the St. Louis gunboats. These had come up from Fort Donelson, and they had brought Nelson up, Bull Nelson. He was one of the divisions from the Army of the Ohio that was sent to Grant, and Grant sent him up to occupy Nashville. Well, they crossed the river here, and right after this scene, which would have been in early March, these boats went out to the Mississippi, you know, as part of the Mississippi Squadron, and were instrumental in taking Allen Number 10 and all the activity there. Some of the Carondelet boys, Major Edward Mueller, the quartermaster. This is alerted outpost. That's what it says. Vortimer Verpolsten. It's alerted outpost is the translation. This is the Rutherford Creek Bridge. They crossed over the river, they made their way to Nashville, and then they were going to rendezvous at a place called Pittsburgh Landing on the Tennessee River. And that's where they were heading, to Columbia, Tennessee, where the railroad plays out. And this is one of the bridges that they had to rebuild. Of course, Billick and them, they made a brush bridge and crossed over, and the 39th Indiana was tasked with building this bridge. And when they got up to the Duck River, they found that the Confederates had torched that bridge. They were instrumental in rebuilding this bridge so the Army could move on to Pittsburgh Landing and the rendezvous with Grant. And here's General Alexander McDowell McCook. By the full moon in Tennessee of Gate, how the full moon rises in Tennessee. Now, I always like to say, I mean, check this guy's horse out. Does his eyes look like they're bulging out to you? I mean, this horse is a He's going back to his Fatty McCook thing, and he's always poking fun at Fatty McCook. And there were more than just poking at him. Some of the men didn't have much of a high appraisal of McCook. Now, along the way, they went through a beautiful place, Mount Pleasant, Tennessee, and this is where Polk's Church, this is the first Episcopal church built west of the Alleghenies, and it still stands today. And one of the stories related to this church is in 1864, when the Army of Tennessee was moving towards the battles of Franklin, Patrick Cleburne, who could have been probably the best thing the Confederates ever had if he had been in a position of command, he remarked to his aide that, it would almost be worth dying to be buried in such a beautiful place. And then 3 days after the Battle of Franklin, he got his wish. He was buried there with three other generals. Right after we moved down there, I guess it was just a year or so after we moved down to Tennessee, this came into the news. Two drunks broke into this place and vandalized it terribly. But it is. It's an absolutely beautiful place down there. This is, okay, they're moving west from this point. They've gone into Columbia. They've gone to Mount Pleasant. They're moving west and approaching Waynesboro. Now this is the ironworks at Waynesboro. It's just this side of Waynesboro, as a matter of fact. Topographic maps actually show the ruins of this place, just as you can see. Now this was taken advantage. This was built in 1835. Iron production in this region had been going on since 1817. They were taking advantage of 275 square miles of some of the richest iron ore in the United States. And I had no idea until I moved down to this area. And this is just another scene of an unfinished scene, but it shows a skirmish taking place against Confederate cavalry over here on the right-hand bottom. And they're going on up the road there between the building and the hill. But as I said, the ruins of this place are still present today. And they arrive at Shiloh, second day's battle of Shiloh. And this is going through the camps. Now, if you notice, if you take a ruler and lay it across there, round came through here, knocked off their heads, and slammed right into that tree stump right there. And then somebody came along and decided that they didn't need their brogans anymore, so they exchanged brogans with them. But this is a frozen in death. I mean, it happens. This is what this man saw. And, it had to have haunted him. It seems to me in his artwork that from this point on, after experiencing the horror of Shiloh, that his artwork took on a sharper contrast. He was having some sort of struggle. Even the caricatures actually took on sharp features, or gaunt features even. These are some of the 11th Indiana Zouaves that he drew. Thanks to the 32nd Indiana, they arrived at an opportune time to prevent Lew Wallace and his 11th Indiana from being outflanked, and they filled in the hole. And then Lew Wallace actually gave a stirring description of Vilek putting his men through the manual of arms under fire. He came around, he noticed that rounds that the men fired had no effect on the enemy, so he came around on horseback to the front of the men, put his back to the enemy, and had the bugler blowing through the manual of arms until they composed themselves, and then he led them on a bayonet charge forward. And for that, he was promoted to brigadier general later on, probably about 2 months later. Just another scene of the... This is one of the great losses for the 32nd Indiana. This was Frederick Voller. He was the favorite, and he was the color bearer. And for an NCO to receive the colors was a great honor, and he died. And I had the honor to meet the descendant of this young man. She's a nun at Ferdinand, and she was just gave me an enormous amount of information on this individual. But 11th Indiana Zouaves again. This is Robert A. Wolfe, who was a actor of some renown, and he came from New York City, where he had been in the theater, and he was instrumental in organizing the theater in Louisville, and that exists to this day, I believe. Of course, I haven't been for so many years, but because of his viciousness at Shiloh, and you can get a sense of that over on the right-hand side, he does look a little bit like a gorilla, but because of his viciousness, he was promoted to an officer. Here's a member of the Morton Battery, another German organization that was the 6th Indiana, that was organized over here in Evansville. And they were one of two German batteries that was organized there. This is a state line where Tennessee and Mississippi meet. And if you've ever been down in that area, it doesn't look unlike that today, And this is one that I absolutely love. There's our boy, Levinsky. He goes by about six different names. In the census records, he spells his name one way, and he spells his kids another way. But notice the threadbare on his behind there. You know, they're under short rations. They're not being well supplied. Yeah, this is between Shiloh and Corinth, Mississippi. And that's just jungle down through there today. And it was they went through hard times and reduced rations. But you can see that he's gone to the trouble. Over here on the right hand, you see that boot laying there? And that's his mat. He's gone to the trouble to put one boot on so he could kick his Captain Erdelmeyer awake. You know, rank does have its privileges, they say. I guess being an officer's aide had its privileges as well. This is just a scene of sniping that became the mainstay of the battle. And okay, this is the approach of the Beauregard. This is called the Beauregard Line. It was a network of extensive defenses that faced the Union Army as they approached. However, there wasn't a single gun, or never had been a single gun in any of these redoubts. They had put Quaker guns, logs painted to look like cannon. And it worked rather well. It was the greatest act of subterfuge for the Confederate Army at that time to get out of Corinth, Mississippi, making the Yankees think that they were facing an enormous army that just didn't exist. This is the Tishomingo Hotel, a very historic structure. This is at the intersection of the north-south, east-west rail line. And it became of course, it was Beauregard's headquarters. Naturally, after Shiloh, it became a hospital, a Union hospital again, Union headquarters. After the Second Battle of Corinth, it was occupied. And it survived till 1864 when it was put to the torch by the Union as they departed Corinth during the Army of Tennessee under Hood as they came back up for the battles of Franklin and Nashville. The Union burned it to the ground. Likewise, this scene of the City Hall. That's August Willick and the 32nd coming in on May 31st to take over as the Provost Guard. They were assigned Provost Guard duty for a week before they moved on towards Chattanooga. And this is a Corona Women's College that has a very long history in its own right, but it was dismantled in sections to build different defenses around the city of Corinth. Part of it was demolished by the Confederates, and the remainder of it was demolished by the Union for the 1862 Battle of Corinth. Here's Fritz Bossenvernick. This is an NCO telling one of the pioneers that you absolutely will do what I tell you to do. And apparently, Metzner looked at the individual as a small man in more ways than just one. But here's U.S. Cavalry taking a lesson in surgery. It's definitely cavalry. You can tell that the yellow piping and the spurs on their boots, and the woman's given birth, and there's the midwife, and they're quite entertained with the spectacle. Mick and the Rattlesnake. This individual got bit by a rattlesnake. You can see him getting, of course, the Germans, they were big on their beer and on their wine, but August Willick kept a special container for he's getting whiskey right there, and they've treated this. The 15th Ohio, Alexis Cope, he kept a diary and he created a very extensive book after it. And at this particular place, there were more than six rattlesnake bites, and three men drowned, and one got beat up by a hive of the hornets. So, and this was at this place. But you can see who over here looking over here in the background. Guess who that is? Batty McCook. And this is just a scene where Erdelmeyer got his tent knocked down during a storm from the river. You can just barely see up there in the top right, that's the city of Florence, and you can see the three different panels that he created. This bridge at the bottom, that was destroyed by Sherman in, around March of 1862. And then there is the upper panel, and then the Women's College in the center right there. Well, today, that building is still there. And this is Hannah. This was a German down in this area, this German lady in Florence. There were a lot of Germans in Florence. And she was complaining about how the soldiers make too much noise for her to get a good night's sleep. And that was just a real quick sketch. But here's the Florence Female College, and today that's the administrative buildings of the North Alabama University. Beautiful place, but since the Civil War, it's lost its main power right there. Rogersville. This was just a mean little place on the road to Chattanooga. See, they were making this move east from Corinth, Mississippi, to occupy Chattanooga. That was the plan, but Wager Halleck, who was in command of all the armies, said, well, you gotta build your railroads and your supply lines. Instead of taking 2 days or 3 days to get straight to Chattanooga, with bare arms. He had Buell building and maintaining railroads, which depleted his army, and to no avail because the Confederate cavalry were just running circles around. They didn't have any cavalry with them, the Union didn't. And it's good to be king. This man's been promoted to sergeant, and essentially that's what it says down here. You know, when you get to the rank of sergeant, you're on the rank, you're on this level to higher things, is what the German essentially says. Captain William Erland, a Louisville individual, he and his two brothers had moved to Louisville after coming to the United States, and he ended up resigning his commission right after his youngest brother got killed at Liberty Gap, and then his other brother had been wounded severely at Stones River. And after the war, he and the one that had been wounded at Stones River moved to Nebraska and started a new life. And he's the second one. When he died, his brother married his wife, and that's the second time that I've encountered this with this regiment. Von Trebra, when he died, Louis Von Trebra married his wife. And here's a scene in Huntsville, Alabama, and if you'll notice here on the ground, Metzner's portfolio. He carried that with him during the entire war, and that's where he kept the art that he worked on. And this is Louis Von Trebra, and Metzner's got his back to you. He's always got his back to you in the upper bunk. And of course, there's Lewinsky over there up to no good. Along this way, now, up to this point, up to the Battle of Shiloh, it had been one of the wettest seasons on record to that time. The winter of 1862, end of the spring, and almost up to May 31st, it was one of the wettest on record. And right after that, somebody turned off the tap, and they didn't turn it on again except for flash floods until October the 8th of 1862. And we've experienced that here in our own area, you know, those extended long droughts. But they had one of them beginning here, so every water source along the way was a prize. You can see that each man has multiple canteens right there, and then the long blue line in the back is the men are on the march. And of course, one of the things that the Confederates like to do is catch these guys all by their lonesome. Here's Jacob Levinsky, scared to death, and that's exactly what it says on the back side. He's been rousted by Confederate cavalry as he's gone to get water. And then there's a drawing that it actually appears in the collection. The one of Mank over there on the left-hand side, it was done in 1861, because that's the only time he was in the uniform of an 11th Indiana Zouave. Good old country ways, Landlich Sittlich, and it does pay to have rank. This is our good buddy Fatty McCook. You can see he's got milk on tap in the background, and this just happens to be when at one of the times when they were on less than half rations. And of course, that didn't apply to officers, as you can plainly see. And I still haven't figured out the story. Let me go back to this guy. I still haven't figured out the story of this guy up underneath the tent. But I guess you can use your own imagination. But you know, he's waiting for his supper and waiting for that milk on tap. This is one of the flash floods I was speaking of, and this is along the Tennessee River watershed. There's Lieutenant Walter, and I haven't been able to figure out which Walter he is because there's about a half a dozen of them in the Army of the Ohio at this time. Dead mule with his feet straight up in the ground, and they're providing Metzner and Von Trebra some water by pole. This is a young lady's call to the outpost, the picket line. This is Metzner again, right here. Got his back to you again, but it's obvious who he is. And of course, the outer picket line. But this, you know, almost from the time they arrived at Corinth, Mississippi, and on, they were followed by what they called the contrabands during this time. And this continued all for every army, just about. Every Union army had its camp followers. And a lot of them were put to work. Now, here's one, it's called Innocence, you know, and it's a contraband. He has the contraband signature up here. But this is a young man. We're leaving him without any discretion whatsoever. You know, I guess when you got to go, you just got to go. Okay, now they've arrived here at Battle Creek, Tennessee, on this route to, and this is August the 24th. They've arrived at, they've been at Battle Creek, Tennessee for several days. There's been all these promotions. August Villick is now a brigade commander. Von Trebra has become the regiment commander. They learn at this time that Bragg is on the way to Kentucky, the invasion of the Bluegrass. So they essentially make this mad race for Louisville, and that's what the next month was, a mad race back to Louisville. And you can see that, you know, you hear about Sherman and his bummers. Well, our boys here in the Ohio Valley and the Army of the Ohio, they were practicing that bomb before it became popular with Sherman. You can see this young man standing there, one of the Louisville Legion. It says the 6th Kentucky. Of course, the Louisville Legion was the 5th Kentucky. But you can see that right there. 6th Kentucky is right there, but it's not the same signature as the one above it. Louisville Legion, 1862, Colonel Rousseau. But you can see down in the bottom there at the farmhouse, there's all kinds of critters running around the yard. He's already got a chicken slung over his back, and he's looking at the menu down there. So, and then they've arrived at Louisville. There's the pursuit of Bragg over near Perryville. You've got three lines, one going out east towards Frankfort, Lawrenceburg. Then you've got the center line that's going out towards Bardstown. Then you've got the other line that's going out a different route to Bardstown. But the center line and the right line converge at a place called Perryville on October the 8th. But while that's going on the extreme Union left out near Lawrenceville, Kentucky, the 2nd Division that had left out and gone down the Middletown Road had been constantly harassed from the time they left Louisville until they turned on the aggressors at a place called Dog Walk. They had been harassed by Kirby's cavalry under an excellent leader, and finally they turned on them. And this is the battle line of Company A. And Company A sustained 5 casualties, and you can see one of them ended up dead, and he's laying over there on the side right there. But 3 more men were wounded. There was a total of 5 men from the different regiments buried. They buried them on the spot and moved on and finally reunited with the rest of the army out near Crab Orchard, Kentucky. But those men are some of the very few Union dead that have never been recovered in national cemeteries. They're still laying out there on private property to this day, and the state of Kentucky has identified every one of them now. Henry Von Traber at this time, at Crab Orchard, he had to leave the Army. He had contracted typhoid and had carried this typhoid all the way back, and finally Crab Orchard, he broke down. They sent him back home to Illinois, and he died from the effects of the disease, complications. But that's the somberness of this particular one. I put that at that time because it was a blow to the regiment, but at that same time, Captain Von Traber became, or Captain Erlemeyer became Lieutenant Colonel of the 32nd Indiana, and he took the regiment in to Stones River. And the 32nd Indiana was on the extreme Union right. Imagine a giant fish hook. And they were the barb and the actual hook of the line, the Union line there. And they were, on the 31st of December, they were just overwhelmed by advancing Confederates, 3 lines of Confederates. And this drawing here is just by guess, because in reality, Villick and one of the doctors were coming back from headquarters, and both of them were shot out of their horses. Both their horses were killed from a grape shot. And they both hit the ground and were captured by the Confederates, but not long after this, they were reintroduced to Terry's Texas Rangers. Willick was supposed to say, "I'd rather be dead than be captured by Terry's Texas Rangers," but that was the fortunes of war. He ended up going to Libby prison for the next 6 months. This is after the battle, just a real quick sketch, but it's so much similar to this one. And this is actually Erlemeyer and Lieutenant, or Colonel Mank, well, later Colonel Mank, described in different, in official report and in newspaper letters, they described taking position. The 32nd Indiana was overwhelmed. They lost 115 men were captured immediately. Erlemeyer was able to grab one cannon and 90 of his men, and they took, they did a fighting retreat, and they fell in behind a picket fence, a wooden fence. And Erlemeyer and both Mank, in their letters and official reports, speak to firing volley after volley after volley at the advancing Confederates until they were piled one on top of another. And this is just the scene that Metzner took away from them. You see the carrion birds up at the top moving in, and that was one of the things they speak to after the battle, the carrion, and not only the carrion, but the hogs. As they did in Shiloh, the hogs were there feeding on dead bodies. Frank Erlemeyer at Stones River. This is General Johnson's headquarters. At this time, after the Battle of Stones River, they laid there for 6 months while Rosecrans fought with Washington about getting supplies and everything, but during this time they had a lot of court-martials. They court-martialed our boy, Lieutenant Wolf. He was the one that got promoted because of his viciousness at Shiloh, but after Shiloh and they moved on Corinth, he sustained a severe heat injury and just went bonkers. He was literally bonkers, and a heat injury is a terrible thing. It's something that you don't get over right away, if ever. You know, in some instances, a heat injury can last for the rest of your days. Well, they speak to him just going bonkers, and on the back of this it said, court-martialed for kissing a nurse. Now, that might be problematic, considering that there were very, very few female nurses during the Civil War, so, and this was probably before Don't Ask, Don't Tell as well, so. But actually, he resigned, in all fairness to Lieutenant Wolf, he resigned for the good of the service, but he was actually totally out of his head from then on. This is the only non-Metzner image I put in here, but it was in the collection, because it's got August Willick laying here in bed. He was a genius, a military genius, August Willick, but he wasn't too bright when it comes to common sense. He was infested with lice. And in order to cure the lice, he used mercury to cure the lice. So, you know, he wasn't real bright in that regard. I mean, he didn't have a lot of medical background, apparently, but that's what put him in the bed there. This is not long after that, he was paroled. And they were exchanged. He went to Washington and then spoke to President Lincoln about how they could have walked into Richmond at any time, while the entire time he was there. But these are three gentlemen. This is Schmidt, his adjutant, Carl Schmidt, Evansville, Indiana resident, rather. Allegedly, he and Willick had served together in the Revolution. And this is Mank right here. And this gentleman, his name's Brown, but this is at Laverne, Tennessee, and there just happens to be newspaper accounts that speak to this very thing. Mortgage raiders, or even Forrest, or several other cavalry groups, they stopped the train, they stripped everybody, every soldier that was on it was stripped of all of his uniforms. You can see these guys are left in their skivvies, essentially. And each one of them's holding a parole list in their fist. Of course, here's the Confederates going off into the moonlight. But they were on the way to meet Willick. Willick was coming down to Nashville, so they were going to Nashville to meet him and escort him back. Now, this is another one that didn't make it into the collection, or into the photograph collection. Another family member out in California had this, and the owner of the artwork wasn't even aware this existed, but she had sent me a copy out of it when I asked her if I could see it. I knew what it was, but I wanted to make sure. I sent a copy of this to Jim Lewis down here at Stones River. He's the head historian down there, and he just went ape over it because this is the only Civil War view of Fort Rosecrans down there at Murfreesboro, and they have now got this as an interpretive panel down there. So I'm going to chalk up another one for me. You know, the monument and this, you know, so, you know, what more can you ask for? But they do. They've got this on as an interpretive panel down there. And I'm real proud of that. This is polishing the general's breeches. Actually, this is Edward Mueller. He's the quartermaster. But, you know, from what I've learned of this individual, he put himself above everybody. You know, he's one of those type of individuals. Almost a, what would you call, austere German, you know. But you can see that this young man gets no delight out of polishing the general's breeches, so to speak. And oh, these are leather chaps. And over here in the tent, these two guys are just yucking it up big time. But this is the last time you ever see our boy Levinsky in the artwork. After this, he goes AWOL and disappears. But it says, "You are the father, don't deny it." And you got to admit, there is a family, there is a bit of a resemblance between this donkey right here. And there is a resemblance. But here's old Erdemeyer. He's in the background just taking it all in. A little bit of horseplay, you know. The soldier never loses his sense of humor. But he shows up later. He goes AWOL, disappears completely. This is 1863. He disappears completely. They go on to fight the battles of Atlanta, and then they're coming back to get out, you know, almost to a man, they refuse to reenlist. So the three-year men are coming back to Chattanooga. Levinsky comes out of the clouds, and here he is. He's ready to get out of the Army with them. So they let him go out. They don't charge him with desertion or anything like that. What it was, he was down in North Alabama. He found him the honey down there. So after the war, he goes back there, and he plants all kinds of kids in the ground, and he's got, I think, seven kids at one point. So he went back to northern Alabama and became a Southerner. This particular gentleman is another one that knowing his personality from what I've read about him, you get the sense of his personality from that upturned nose. But that was just one of those quick sketches that, after Murfreesboro, of course, after 6 months of wrangling, Rosecrans decides he's going to go fight again. They start moving south to Liberty Gap. And if ever you've been down in that area, you talk about one beautiful place. This is just, but it's one hell of a place to fight a war. It is the ugliest terrain, both straight up and straight down. But this is one of those instances where, you know, they moved into the Gap. And this is the first time that Billick, he's always introducing these new programs. He introduced what they called advanced firing, where there is almost a continuous line of fire. They have one line that's moving forward that fires, the next line comes up and fires, or the other lines, it's just a sequence of four lines stepping forward at the same time and firing, to where they have this constant line of hail going down range. And that's one of the first places that he introduced that. And it was typically, they would march up in mass, fire their weapons, march up in mass again, and Billick was losing too many people. He said, no, we can't do that. So he devised this way to put a massive amount of fire on the Confederates, to where they actually pushed the Confederates. Patrick Claiborne, as a matter of fact, pushed him back through the gap. And then they abandoned it and flanked not only Patrick Claiborne, but the Confederate Army out of Chattanooga. This is just one of the maps. At this time, Messner has become a cartographer for the 2nd Division under Johnson. So he's in headquarters at this point. But he had been captain of Company K. But now he is the cartographer. And this is just a map of Winchester, the Winchester area. This is on the road to a place called Chickamauga Creek. I believe this is Sand Mountain, where they're literally pushing and pulling these cannon and caissons up that mountainside. And they all meet at a place called Chickamauga. This is the 32nd Indiana. August Billick and his brigade at Chickamauga near the Kelly House. That's what you see back over here in the background. The 32nd Indiana was separated from their division and sent to augment General Thomas over on the extreme Union left. And it was Billick was one of those individuals who helped Thomas earn that nickname, the Rock of Chickamauga. And they were actually the rear guard. Once the Union line disintegrated there at Chickamauga, there was this mass move to retreat to Chattanooga. Billick's brigade was the rear guard and kept up being the rear guard all the way back to Ringgold. You can see this over here on the right-hand side, this portion of it. You know, he is always creating different samples as though he's trying to perfect what he's doing. And that's what this is right here. You recognize that? Go back, it's the exact same scene almost, except that he's trying to get it just right, I think. But that was just lost on the field. Now this is one I really like. This is almost one of my favorites. But the German inscription on this says, Gestern noch auf Stolzen Rosen. Yesterday, still proud on horseback. That happens to be the second sentence of a second stanza of an old Prussian war song from the 1840s. And this is his self-image, self-portrait of him being wounded at Chickamauga. A round entered his right leg just above the ankle, killed his horse. The horse in turn rolled over the top of him, broke three ribs, and he ended up being shipped back to the Chesterfield House at Chattanooga. And of course the whole army fell back into Chattanooga. Here's Lookout Mountain. This is General Billick's quarters. Of course, Billick was very eccentric. There's a pet raccoon here, and he's receiving a report from one of his officers. But this actually is perfectly aligned with where they were. They were just east of the mountain. General Grant arrived at the Chesterfield House, and Messner was able to see him, and all descriptions show him just like you see him here. There were actual physical descriptions, how he arrived wet and sodden, and Messner captured it perfectly. And then Missionary Ridge, that happened on November the 25th. But this is the one drawing in this entire collection that I know Messner didn't witness, because after the Chesterfield House, he was sent back to Louisville. But he arrived, he was sent back to Louisville, then to Cincinnati for further treatment. But he was there at Cincinnati and was able to come down to Madison, Indiana to escort his dear friend Jacob Glass of Company B at 32nd Indiana. He got killed climbing the ridge at Missionary. Took a round right through the weight, you know how they were, the sash.
the sash, the bullet went right through the sash, and it, at that very time they say, now the family lore is that his mother collapsed. He was the sole provider for his mother. And she allegedly collapsed and said, my baby's dead. And that, of course, that's family lore. But they escorted the body back, and Lieutenant Colonel, now Mank, gave the eulogy graveside, and they speak to the eulogy in the newspapers. They don't give a translation, but what it says is, Un deutsches Blut in diesem Krieg, der Gossen ist auch Menschenblut. And German blood shed in this war is also human blood. Keep in mind, this is after the debacle at Chancellorsville, where the 11th German, the largely learned German 11th Corps, is made the scapegoat for that command failure, and even though it's not very well warranted. But this not only speaks to the loss of this friend, but this resurgence of anti-German sentiment all across the country, caused by our press, who hardly ever makes a mistake. This is immediately after the Battle of Missionary Ridge, the unit was, the 32nd Indiana with 3rd Division, was shipped north, or shipped to Knoxville, to augment Burnside at Knoxville against Longstreet. Longstreet had come down to Virginia to help Bragg at Chickamauga, but they butted heads so hard that Longstreet just packed up and said, you're on your own, bud. He headed over to Knoxville to invest Burnside. Well, they sent these guys over there, 32nd Indiana. They had still not had received any supplies of clothing. They were still in the clothes they were wearing at Chickamauga. And they asked them to re-enlist for the duration there. And almost to a man, there was one man out of all the survivors that joined for the duration. All the rest of them said, no, we're going home. And then some of them came home, you know, they came home and then actually joined other regiments. You know, this the German regiment was it's losing its ethnicity at this time anyway. September 1863, they actually took in galvanized Yankees. Irishmen, of all things, mixing Irish and German together. But that's what they did. They had prisoners up in Indianapolis that they were holding, and these men swore an oath of allegiance, and they all came down and joined the 32nd Indiana, and there was a good many Irishmen in there. But this is the cannon, signal cannon firing for the kicking off the move on Atlanta. And one of the first places that they ended up was Resaca. This is the example of trench warfare we would experience later in the 20th century, although we got our fair share of it during the Civil War. This guy right here is he's just a character all his own. Anton Kazimir Dilger. And he was actually, that's him over here on the left side in the uniform of Baden. He was the Duke of Baden's master of flying artillery. And he asked, after the Battle of Bull Run, he requested permission to come to America to get some experience. Of course, the Duke of Baden was more than happy to let him go, even though he was such an asset to him, mainly because his beautiful daughter was smitten with Dilger. And, you know, he's got that whole Errol Flynn thing going on over there. But this is him. He's actually the German inscription indicates that he's inspecting the effect of his battery's fire on a Confederate battery in a fort at Resaca. Now, this is where also that August Billick took a serious round to the throat from a Mississippi musket, and it actually almost ended his career. They sent him back to recover at Cincinnati. He became the garrison commander of Cincinnati, but rejoined the Army in Texas as Army of Observation. Of course, if you're a Texan, I would imagine it was the Army of Occupation. But they were down there to show strength to the French over in Mexico. Just a survey crew at Marietta, Georgia. This is leeches. This guy's covered with leeches at this river here. And Alexis Cope, this is the Chattahoochee River. And Alexis Cope actually reports a beautiful scene there at the river and said it was something worth artist easel. And of course, Messner saw it a different way when this guy comes up out of the water with the leeches covering him. But this is one of the last drawings, unfinished drawing or watercolor that he made. This is the action at Peachtree Creek. And I wished he would have finished it because it would absolutely be marvelous. Just Carl Baer, he's one of the, he was actually a steward, a hospital steward all through the Army. He was like a babysitter for some of the young men. They began the war with Uncle Billy when they came into Louisville. Uncle Billy Sherman was in charge. Major Anderson, Colonel Anderson, had already given up command after being wore out from Fort Sumter. Uncle Sherman was there. course, within a couple of weeks, he was deemed absolutely bonkers because he's saying he's needing 200,000 troops on his front. And turns out he wasn't too far off. This is another one that didn't make it into the photographer's collection. Shows Sherman coming through a fort and how they've turned the cannon around and they're firing on the Confederates. And then this is the ultimate in Metzner's artwork. This, to me, is the culmination of everything that he did. This is the only one of the few post-war oils that I know exists by Metzner. This sucker is 20 foot long. And it's over his fireplace right now after a nice couch.
Maybe on that note we'll stop, so we'll have a minute or two for questions.
So in the Civil War, when they're forming regiments, how much of that was done on an ethnic basis, like the 32nd Jerk in Indiana here, and how much of it was regional?
Well, good question. Now, most companies in Indiana, for example, came from congressional districts. So you might have three or four counties where the men came from those congressional districts. With the German regiments, these were men who bound together independently in order to show that they were, you know, they wanted to prove to Americans that they were worthy of citizenship. And that's what drove a lot of these ethnic regiments, was the desire to prove their citizenship, you know, that they're worthy of being Americans. And in the case of 32nd Indiana, you had companies that were formed in all the major cities of Indiana. You had one company that came, actually they say as many as 2.5 companies came from Cincinnati, because Willich was a Cincinnati citizen, and every German in Cincinnati knew him, so you had this massive number of Ohioans that went up to Indianapolis to join with him. But as far as the ethnic regiments, it seems that they formed in order to prove their citizenship, you know, their worthiness, you know, and that was the only reason that they did it, you know. Now, every regiment, I haven't come across a regiment yet that doesn't have Germans in it. I mean, that's on both sides, you know, really. You know, there's German surnames, and they like to say that there was something like 250,000 Germans, but I believe there was far more than that that actually served the Union. Now, there were Confederate German regiments as well. You've probably heard of Galveston being taken by the Confederates. Well, that was the Houston Turner Rifles, you know, Germans from Houston that played a role in capturing Galveston back from the Union. Anyone else?
Other questions?
No, but I'm fascinated. Because I'm a Gettysburg girl.
Yeah.
And I went to school, a private school, just 20 miles past of Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. And I have a disagreement with you on nurses, and
Oh yeah, there were female nurses. No, there were female nurses, but
we don't have time for it. Yeah. It's an interesting story.
A little token for our author.
And it is a token. It is really a lot of fun to hear the stories of the war as it leaves Maryland and Gettysburg, mm-hmm. and all of that.
Yeah.
And I just did not know. But we thank you. This was a lot of fun.
Oh, I appreciate you inviting me. I enjoy it. I enjoy it all.
And this is for you.
Oh,
I have no idea
much.
What it is. Go home and look at it.
And
but thank you so
they
much.
They left the books at the counter.
Yes.
So, yeah, if you're interested in obtaining a copy of Mr. Peake's book, there's a copies up at the counter up here. And we want to thank you and the
author. Yeah,
I love
doing it.
Thanks to Barnes & Noble. Thanks very much.
Well, I'm glad you did it.
I don't care if it's two or three.